We are about to read one of the best and clearest pictures in the Old Testament of what it looks like when a son of David rules well. Now, there were sons of David that ruled over Israel. There was a son of David that ruled over Israel anyway. And then there were sons of David that ruled over Judah. Solomon ruled well for a while, but we know there's only one son of David who is really going to rule well. And it's really interesting to me. We're in the life of Solomon right now. We've gone through his prayer for wisdom and understanding, and now we get a chapter that's dedicated to what his kingdom was like. That's the whole chapter's dedicated for. He's only, where we are in his life, he's only 18, 19 years old, somewhere around there. But this looks forward. This, as the writer of 1 Kings, which some believe it was Jeremiah, some believe that it was others. We really don't know. It's like the book of Hebrews. We don't exactly know who wrote the book of 1 Kings. But the author wanted to give us a picture of what Solomon's kingdom was like. And we're going to get a few of them as we make our way through. But this is the clearest for the whole thing. And Solomon is a type of the Messiah. And his reign is a type of the millennium, when Jesus will rule and reign on this earth for 1,000 years, when swords will be beaten into plowshares because people are not making war anymore. That's why when people say, well, we're in the millennium now, it's like, I don't think so. I think you got, that's really problematic. Satan is chained up for 1,000 years. They don't make war anymore. People walk in safety. The child plays by the viper's den. We don't encourage that, you know. I think there's a rattlesnake out back, you know. Honey, go out and check it out. We don't do that, right? But he rules with a rod of iron, it says, during the millennium. And it says this in a few places. What it means is, and those who are alive during the millennium are those who have made it through the tribulation period. And so they populate the earth over that 1,000 years. Those of us who have been with Christ, those who have died and resurrected, we will be living in eternity while they are living in time. And so there will be animals. The wolf will lay down with the lamb. The lion will lay down with the calf. And it says it will be a time of safety, that people will be able to just walk out in the open and be safe. They don't have to worry about who's around them and what's around them. We're just so used to that now. We're constantly looking to see what's going on, because I don't know that our government sees itself as having to do that job. But that's the millennium. What Jesus is going to do is show us what the world could have been like had everyone decided to follow Jesus, had he really been the one who was on the throne. Now, I want to show you, first of all, that David is a type of Solomon. I mean, excuse me, that was really messed up. That Solomon is a type of the Messiah. So in 1 Samuel 7, verse 12, it says, "When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers," this is to David, "I will set up a seed for you who will come from your body. I will establish his kingdom." Now, it's talking about Solomon, and it's talking about Christ. This is one of the ways in which prophecy works. There's close fulfillment, near fulfillment, and far fulfillment. I used to say there is an incomplete fulfillment and a complete fulfillment. But talking to Dr. Ed Henson when he was here a few years ago for one of our conferences, he was just persuaded that that's the wrong way to talk about it, but it's a near fulfillment and a far fulfillment instead. And both of them are partial. The near fulfillment can't fulfill what the far fulfillment will fulfill, and vice versa. So it's talking about Solomon. I will establish his kingdom. And Jesus, it says, he shall build a house for my name. That's the temple. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And that's where the Messiah comes in. Because it is Jesus who will sit on the throne of David, not only for the millennium, but forever. I will be his father, and he will be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the son of men. So you see there how there's part that Solomon can fulfill and can't fulfill, and there's parts that Jesus can fulfill, but he can't fulfill. Like, he's not going to commit iniquity. The Bible says he was tempted in every way we are tempted, yet without sin. Now, I do want to, and I wanted to look at doing it tonight, but I also wanted to cover this passage in its entirety. I want to go over the different kinds of prophecies that are in the Bible. There are what we call one-for-one prophecies. They don't have near or far fulfillment. They're just said about Jesus. They're clearly about the Messiah when they're given, and they're clearly about Jesus, and he fulfilled them clearly. There are one-for-one prophecies. Then there are near and there are far prophecies, and there are other kinds of prophecies that are in the scriptures as well, and we won't do it tonight, but I just kind of want to get you ready for that. If you can see something about that, if you want to study it, you see a YouTube video where someone's covering that, kind of get familiar with it, because I think a lot of times we're mistaken about how prophecy worked in the Middle East. It's not our culture. It was their time. They're living in a completely different time. Think back to Abraham living 4,000 years ago, just or perhaps even a little bit longer than that. Just amazing. Before the law was ever given, we think about Jacob, Leah and Rachel fighting over mandrakes for their husband, right? That's not like the law. That's not like under Moses. That's like before that time, and such a time that we have a hard time understanding. So if you can get familiar with the kind of prophecies that are out there, it will help when we really end up diving into it. Now, when people think about Solomon, they usually think about wisdom. And Solomon has been given wisdom, but Jesus is wisdom. So we can see in a lot of different ways in which Solomon is like Christ. Now, Solomon will end up failing severely, so much to the point that we wonder whether or not he's in heaven. I hope he is. I mean, Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, at the end of Ecclesiastes, he says, what's the end of this then? That as a young man, serve God. Because the whole book of Ecclesiastes is, it's all vanity. I've gone through my life and I've tried everything that's out there, and everything is empty. He just went down the checklist. What's the end of it? Serve God when you're young. So it gives me hope that Solomon will be in heaven. And what a good thing for someone to have chased down everything that's out in the world and then say, serve God while you're young. That's what's important. That's the end of all of it. That's what it was talking about. Now, there is order in provision and peace and people inside of this chapter, and it shows us the wisdom that he had as he made his way through. There are places in the Old Testament where God gives you a real moment in history, and at the same time gives you a picture of something that is greater than that. And that's here. Matthew 12:42 said, the queen of the south will rise up in judgment. This is Jesus speaking. The queen of the south will rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed, a greater than Solomon is here. So when we're studying the life of Solomon and we hear about his wisdom, and then we hear Jesus say, a greater than Solomon is here. And as I said before, it's because Solomon was wise, but Jesus is wisdom. So when we read 1 Kings 4, we are not just looking at Solomon, we're looking at what the kingdom of Jesus is going to be like, what the millennial kingdom will be like. So let's start by looking at verses 1-6. So it says, so King Solomon was king over all of Israel. There were only two kings who were. Well, okay, let's say three. There was Saul, it wasn't an official kingdom. It was more of the tribes, and it was the beginning of the kingdom, and he was a king, but it wasn't really until David came in and made some peace. He was a man of war, and through strength, he made peace to hand this over to his son, Solomon. So Saul, David, and Solomon. Solomon has a son by the name of Rehoboam. He takes over the kingdom. And Rehoboam is just, he wants to tax the people. And the counselors of Solomon say, don't do it. But he wants more money, which is always the case with taxes, isn't it? You always want more. And then you find out that there's all kinds of fraud with the taxes anyway. It's like, I do agree, clean it up before you start trying to get more in it. Maybe we're doing things that we shouldn't be doing with the taxes. But Rehoboam wanted to tax people more, and the counselor said, don't do this. The people won't love you. You'll drive the people from you. And he said, my father taxed with his pinky, and I will tax with my waist. He was comparing how much more he was going to tax them. And so it says that the people disliked him, and the 10 tribes of Israel left. And so the throne of David remained in Jerusalem, in Judea, but now you had a divided kingdom, Judea and Israel. You had the 10 tribes in Israel and basically 2 tribes. You really had Benjamin, Judah, and parts of Simeon. And plus there were those that had crossed back and forth because they were the nation of Israel, and those who lived in both parts of the land. And you see that when you go through the Old Testament. But it was a divided kingdom after this, which will tell you how hard it is to keep things together. And then it says, and there were his officials. And then it goes through the officials' names. It says, Azariah, the son of Zadok, the priest. And it gives the different people that are with it. I'm not going to fight all of these names tonight, although I'm sure you'll miss it. And then again, maybe not. But he goes on to talk about Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahiliad, the recorder. So he has his priest listed first, and then the one who would keep the records. When you're running something as big as it is, then you need to have the record straight. Benaiah, we've met him a lot so far in our study. He's a Joab kind of a character, an Abner kind of a character. He was the head of the army for Solomon. It goes on to say then that he had a couple of the priests, Zadok and Abiathar, the priest. Azariah and Nathan were officials. You had Zobad, son of Nathan, a priest and the king's friend. So it talks about Solomon having a friend who was a priest. As Yashar over the household of Adoram, over the labor force. So all of this is a cabinet. It's like his cabinet that's been put together to be able to run things. Now, here is the structure of Solomon's kingdom. Wisdom proceeds with order and capable leadership. Wisdom knows you cannot do it on your own. Wisdom knows you've got to delegate. And in order to delegate, you probably don't want to micromanage. I realize that people's leadership styles are different. My leadership style isn't to micromanage, and there are people that thrive under it, and there are people who don't. There are people that need to be micromanaged. They need to have the direction laid out for them constantly. And there are people that do better when they're given some rope. I like to say about our staff that I give them enough rope to do the job or hang themselves. And I don't really mean that literally. I just mean it's either going to reveal they're able to do it or they're not able to do it. But I don't want to tie their hands. And when you minister that way, when you've got officials who are doing things for you, you find out that they're gifted in areas that you are not gifted in. I think about Troy has been with us since the early 90s. He's our associate pastor. And I think of God bringing us together to do what we do and how our personalities are just so radically different and our gifting from God is radically different, but God has allowed it to complement the work that we do here. And the same thing with all of the people that are on staff. They come in and they have their own gifts and they fit in place. And there was a time that we didn't have them. And after we have them, we think, how could we have got along without them at all? And you think about running a kingdom that's as big as Solomon's kingdom. So in 2 Samuel 23:3, it says, the God of Israel, the rock of Israel, spoke to me. He who rules over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. So remember one of the things that Solomon prayed for was understanding for justice. He wanted to treat people right. He wanted to be just. I think that that should be the desire for every government official, for every judge, for every lawyer. But I also think it ought to be the desire for every person in a church. There are times when people don't think we've treated them right. And sometimes you look back and you think we could have done things better. We do want to be just in all of the ways that we are interacting with people. Sometimes you have to make hard decisions, but you want to be just in all of that. So in 1 Kings 4, 7 through 19, we have the governors that are listed. So these are 12 different governors. I'm not going to go through and read all of them, but they are 12 different governors. We'll read some of them. They each are to provide provisions for the kingdom for 1 month. So they work year-round in collecting their provisions for 1 month. So when you think about the size of the kingdom, it's a good way to run it. You had somebody that was giving energy to every month, not just kind of running that particular area, but seeing it all. We start in verse 7. It said, and Solomon had 12 governors overall who provided food for the kingdom and his household. Each one made provisions for 1 month of the year. Now, again, just a wise way to do it. Now, these are the names, and it starts with Ben-Hur. And we're familiar with Ben-Hur. He looks a lot like Charlton Heston, right? And he's from the mountains of Ephraim, which would be a descendant of Joseph. Now, in the Bible, Ben, like Ben-Hur, is the son of Hur. And so we're going to see a lot of these go by their name. And I did a little bit of research on it because there's a lot I didn't know. Was someone called Ben-Hur until their dad Hur died? And then were they called Hur themselves instead of Ben-Hur? And that wasn't the case, by the way. If their name is Ben-Hur, then they're Ben-Hur their entire lifetime. I don't know if you had a son of, if it was something different. Those are things I looked up. I couldn't find. It goes on and says Ben Decker, and then it gives us some other names. And it tells us the land that they're in. The land of Hefer is in the end of verse 10. We have Ben Abinadab of the region of Dor. He had Telpath, the daughter of Solomon's wife. So we know that Solomon's at this point 19 years old. This isn't what his kingdom looked like when he was 19. This is the kingdom he established. They're showing us that picture. And I think in showing us that, they're also showing us that Jesus will provide an incredible amount of order during the tribulation, or during disorder during the tribulation period, but order during the millennium period. And then we have Bana, the son of Ahilud, and he is, in the area from Beth Shean and on the other side of Jokmeam. You have Ben Geber in verse 13 from Gilead. To him belong the towns of Jar and Madisha in Gilead. He also belonged to the region of Ergob in Basham. Basham is on the other side of the Jordan River. You remember that when Moses came through, that they fought some of the enemies on that side of the river. And then when Joshua came through, they ended up killing, and it will mention Gog, the king of Basham here in a few minutes. In fact, it might be right where I'm at. But it will mention him in a few minutes. But part of Manasseh and I think Gad wanted to stay on the other side of the river. And Joshua thought, no, this isn't good. Come, you got to come fight with us for the land. And they said, no, we'll go over and fight, but we want to come back to this land. So the land on the other side, there were cattle, were well fed. They did really well while they were there. So they wanted to stay on that part of the river. So it's a large part as well. It goes on to say that there's six large cities and walls of bronze and gate bars there. In 14, Ahinadab and another Ahimez of Naphtali, he also took Basemath, the daughter of Solomon, for his wife. It goes on here, verse 19, Geber, the son of Uri, the land of Gilead, that's the country of Shion, king of the Amorites, or Og, the king of Bashan. He was the only governor who was in that land. Now, you remember when we were studying earlier about conquering the land, that coming in on that side, that Og had a bed that was like 14 feet tall and 6 feet wide. If he was a couple of feet shorter, Goliath was around 10 feet tall, maybe a touch under 10 feet. And Goliath would dwarf Shaquille O'Neal. And then Gog would have dwarfed Goliath. So if indeed his bed, we don't know exactly how tall he was. They don't give us the measurements, but it just gives us the measurements of his bed. It talks about these giants that were around in their day, the Anakim and the Rephidim, that they had weaver's beams for spears. There's a large Egyptian that Benaiah fights. Remember, it takes the spear away from him and kills him with his own spear. He went up against a giant Egyptian with nothing and defeated him. So he was the only governor that was of the land. The kingdom is sustained through structure. Each region carries responsibility. So each region has a responsibility for providing for the entire land. Now in 1 Kings 4:20, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sands of the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So there, it's just a time of multiplying so that they're like the sands of the sea. In Genesis 22:17, God promises, blessings I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the sand which is on the seashore. That's not only a fulfillment in Solomon's day, but it will be a fulfillment in the millennium as well. Do you know how many Jews there are today in the world? There's, I think, 15 million by now. There's 15 million Jews worldwide. That's such a small number. It really is a small number. And that they were like the sands of the sea. Now, God's keeping his promise. He said that they would be like the sand of the sea. And by the way, there's a lot more promises. We talked about last weekend about Israel and God's promises to them, that because they forsake him, he was going to scatter them among the world, but then he was going to and cause the land to become desolate, but then he was going to restore the land, bring them back, and bring them back spiritually eventually. And we're still looking forward to that time that God will bring them back spiritually. Now in 1 Kings 4:41 through 25, it says, so Solomon reigned over the kingdom of the river to the land of Philistia, of the Philistines. The river here, Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. The river that is spoken of here is the Euphrates. So Solomon didn't reign from the Jordan to the sea, but from the Euphrates. Now, this is the largest section Israel ever ruled over, but it's not as much as God said that he was going to give them. When the millennium period is here, it will be a larger section than ever before. And all people will come to Jerusalem because Jesus will be ruling and reigning from Jerusalem. So it would include Iraq, Syria, Jordan. It would include all of that area when it was part of Solomon's kingdom. Now, Solomon's provisions for one day, it says in verse 22, was 30 cores of fine wheat and 60 cores of meal. I have no idea what a cores is. I think it's a beer, but other than that, 10 fattened oxen. It's a lot though, right? When we read it, we go, I don't know that I need to know, but it's a lot. 10 fattened oxen, 20 oxen from the pasture, and 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. So these are Solomon's provisions for one day. And then verse 24, for the dominion over all of the region of this side of the river from Tipshah even to Gaza, which was a city in those days, but it was a city by the sea. And when we read here that it went all the way from the Euphrates River to the region of the Philistines, the region of the Philistines is modern-day Gaza. The Philistines, though, were European people. They were from the Greek islands. And so when people try to make a connection and say that the Palestinians there today are the Philistines, they're, just because something sounds the same doesn't mean it's the same. That's one of the biggest fallacies that's out there. It's like people calling Easter pagan because of the goddess Estrus. They go, Estrus, Easter? But that's not what Easter. Easter is a word that the Germans used to speak of the resurrection. And it's a different word, but we shortened it into Easter, and that's why we got it. Easter isn't pagan. Christian isn't pagan. It's really important for us to understand that. But you get these connections with these names. The Palestinian peoples that are in the region were there when in the 1800s, when the Ottomans controlled the region. They weren't Ottoman people, they were Arab people. Ottomans were Arabs as well, but they weren't Ottomans themselves, but they lived in the region. And so it's not an easy decision to look at it and to go, how do you get the Palestinians and the Jews, who both were in the land for a while? Now, the Jews were in the land for a lot longer, but where in the world do we rule that way? Where in the world do we go, these people were controlling it 3,000 years ago, so they have it today? Where would we be if that's the case, right? And do we all of a sudden just come to an area and go, okay, we freeze it now. People are people for where they are now, and that's it. When we're from all kinds of different places. My family is supposed to be from Ireland. Two men fled as horse thieves by the name of Furrow that made their way over. Now, originally they were in England. They probably fled from stealing horses in England before they fled from Ireland. That's my pedigree, by the way. That's where I'm from. But you do have a heart for the Palestinians who saw the British mandate give promises to the Palestinians and to the Jews that they were going to have a land. And then they didn't do it. They left without giving it to anybody. And the UN took it over. And the UN had already given part of the land to the Jordanians. They're Palestinians. Now, there's about 50% of the people that live in Jordan are Palestinian. And the other, it's like 40, 60, somewhere along those lines. But they were Palestinian, so it had already been given to them. So when the UN decided to divide it up and to make the two-nation solution, that's how long this has been around, they gave 54% to Israel and the rest of it to the Palestinians. So 46% to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians felt cheated. Even though they were given Samaria and Judea, which is the best of the land, and even though they were given the coastland, which is on the Mediterranean, it's beautiful. And Israel declared themselves a state the next day, May 14, 1948. The Palestinians picked up arms to fight against Israel. They wanted to wipe them off the face of the earth. And it's been a conflict ever since then. I think we should guard against what could end up being racism towards the Palestinians. We should guard against it. We also should be wise in understanding the values of the two different people groups. And there are radical different values. When you see the same thing in Iran today, when they put their missiles under hospitals. And we saw the same thing when they were clearing out the tunnels in Gaza, that they were putting their supplies, their guns and their weapons in children's rooms. And all of those, by the way, are war violations. All of those are war crimes. To fight out of a hospital is a war crime. To fight out of a home where people live is a war crime. So when there's a lot of crying out about Israel having war crimes, well, there are war crimes here. And there certainly were things done even during that Gaza thing that we found out that shouldn't have been done from Israel's side, but a lot more of them on the Palestinian side. I'm just saying it's a lot more complicated than what we think. A lot of times we think we just got it figured out. I hear people that are on the Palestinian side, they should have a two-state solution. Israel left Gaza in 05. They displaced thousands of Jews from the region of Gaza and displaced them. And so I'm down rabbit trail, way down rabbit trail now, and I'm trying to break myself of that. But it is here to some degree, because you've got from the River Euphrates to Gaza, all the way to Gaza, which is a city, but that's the region that Gaza is in today. Now, 1 Kings 4:25 says, "And Judea and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba, so all the days of Solomon." So Solomon's days were known as days of peace. And Jesus is the Prince of Peace. Listen to what it says in Zechariah 3:10. "In that day, says the Lord of hosts, everyone will invite his neighbor under his vine and under his fig tree." It's talking about the millennium. So in Solomon's reign, everybody lived under the fig tree and under their vines. And in the millennium, everybody invites their friends over under the fig trees and the vines. These are connections made by the Bible showing us that this reign of Solomon is a type of the reign of the Messiah. It is a kingdom of peace, of provision for the land, security and safety. Solomon didn't make any wars. There were no wars at all. Now, this is the job of government. And I'm not going to read the passage that I have here, Romans 13, 1 through 7, which tells us to be subject to the government. But what it does say here that's important for us to realize is it says that if you are, the government is put there by God. And secular governments are put into place by God. And they're there for people to find safety. And they don't bear the sword in vain. We would say that they don't have their guns or their tasers in vain. They help to provide peace for us. And it says in Romans 13, if you're doing evil, then be afraid. But if you're doing good, then pray for them, because they're there for our safety. And I appreciate that. I saw one of our officers here today. I don't know if he was just coming to church. If you're here, appreciate your service for us. I got a note from one of the officers that are here about how much we appreciate them, how much we shake their hands, tell them we're glad they're here. We have them here in this day for that, to help keep us safe. That's for safety. And that's how we ought to feel. Now, I don't always feel that way when I'm driving down the road and I see a cop car. When I'm driving down the road and I see a cop car, I hit the brakes even if I'm going slower than the speed limit. I'm like, ooh. And I look down, I'm going like 30 and a 45. I'm like, okay. After I hit the brakes, by the way, I'm going 30 and a 45. And I wasn't even speeding. And that'll tell you, you're doing what's right. Then you see them, you're like, hey, good to see you. That ought to be the way we think about them when we see them along the road, keeping those crazy drivers like Robert in check. All right, so that's one of the reasons for safety and peace during the millennium, because Jesus rules with a rod of iron. Now, Solomon's kingdom is a type of what government looks like when it is done God's way. In Micah 4:4, "But everyone who sits under the vine and under the fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid." So, wouldn't that be nice if we didn't have to lock our doors? If we didn't have to have our Ring cameras up? Which I kind of wonder if they're working for us or against us, by the way. Don't want to make you disturbed about it, but you wonder when something's based at the cloud and they can go look up pictures. It's like, that's interesting. I thought it was an independent system. Guess not. Guess I thought wrong. Isaiah 9:7 says, "Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end." Once Jesus begins to reign, no wonder weapons are turned into plow, are things to use to plow with. Because of his kingdom and peace, there is no end. It says in Psalms 72, 7 and 8, "In his days, the righteous shall flourish, and abundance of peace, until the moon is no more. He shall have dominion from the sea and from the river and from the ends of the earth. So Solomon's kingdom is bigger than Israel was ever, because Jesus' kingdom is around the world. He will serve and rule the entire world. A son of David, a Jew, will sit on the throne in the millennium for 1,000 years, and then we will go on into eternity in a new heaven and a new earth, and we'll live in a new Jerusalem with him. So if you're a Christian who is anti-Semitic, you gotta flip that somehow. You gotta figure out how to change it. We have anti-Semitism on the left and the right today, and it's extremely problematic. And we won't go into all of the reasons that there are, but I think it's demonic at its core. To say that. So in verse 26, and Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen. 2 Chronicles 9:25. Solomon had 4,000 stalls and horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen. So a lot of people will tell me there are contradictions in the Bible. And I'll tell them, one of my responses is, show me one. I did that in high school. Somebody said, I carried a Bible in my back pocket in high school. And somebody said to me, I was talking to them about God, and they said, I don't believe in it because of all the contradictions in the Bible. Poor guy, I pulled out I called it my switchblade because it was just the New Testament. So I pulled out my switchblade and I gave it to him and I said, show me. And he sat there with those little bitty print, flipping through it, trying to find a contradiction. He was never going to be able to find one, right? Never. And so they can't find them. But here's a contradiction. Kings tells us he had 40,000 stalls for his chariots, which means a chariot and the horses, one stall would be for a chariot. Another one, then 2 Chronicles, which has given us the same report, says 4,000 stalls. Now, this is obviously a recorder's mistake. They're recording it. They put down too many zeros. This is common. It's a common variant among manuscripts. A manuscript is something written before the time of the printing press. And when people copied things to have their own copies, or when professionals copied things, there were always variants from what they were copying to what they were copying to. When I found a variant like this as a teenager, I was disturbed. It shook my faith, because I had been taught that the Bible came to heaven like it is here, just floated down. Whoa. Little light glowing from it, and that there's no contradictions or variants in it, and it was just kind of what it is, and I didn't know. At about 18 years old, I got a hold of a book by, I think it's John Lightfoot. I know it's not Gordon, but I think it's John Lightfoot, who wrote a book called How We Got Our Bible, and he talks about the very earthly way we got our scriptures. We got them because people copied them. In the Old Testament, they were scribes. And we have all these that are written like this. And to think that people aren't going to make mistakes, God didn't take over their bodies that they wouldn't make a mistake as they wrote it. But this is a strength and not a weakness. Let me say that again. This is a strength and not a weakness. And you know what I'm going to do? Because I'm out of time, I'm going to stop now. I'm going to pick this up in the middle, because I'm going to throw an audible here, and I'm going to change. I'm not going to finish the whole chapter, because I'm just going to rush through it, and I want to spend time talking about variants and why variants are a positive and not a negative. I'll end really quick with a story. I was invited to the U of A to share with the students, and when I got there, I was invited by someone in the class. And then when I got there, I met the professor. The professor introduced me, and he said, this is Pastor Furrow from Calvary Tucson, and he's going to share with you on the discrepancies in the scriptures. That's how he introduced me. And so when I got up, I said, Professor, by any chance, do you know how many variants there are in the Bible? And he goes, no, I have no idea. And I said, there's thousands. There's tens of thousands of variants. You know why? We have thousands of manuscripts. We have tens of thousands of manuscripts. And if there's a spelling error that is passed on, then that is a variant. And so when I say that the Bible is inerrant, I use very specific language. The Bible is inerrant in the things that it teaches. Even a critic like Bart Ehrman, who is a staunch critic of Christianity, says that not one variant out of the tens of thousands of variants in the thousands of manuscripts, we're not talking about thousands of variants in this, we're talking about the stockpile of manuscripts that are out there. There are thousands of variants in them. He says not one variant makes one difference in any of the doctrines or any of the events within the Bible. That's a pretty strong statement from a critic. If a critic will say that, then you know we're standing on strong ground, and I'll cover it more later on because I'm out of time. So stand with me, would you, rather than hurrying through it, and let's pray together. I just kind of wanted to give you a little bit of information before I left you with a contradiction. Here's a contradiction. Have a good week. God bless you guys, you know. Wanted to give you a little bit of information. Father, thank you for your word. Thank you that we can look at Solomon's reign here and see that he ruled and reigned, and that Jesus will rule and reign, and that his reign is a type of the reign. Lord, we also think about the way you gave us the Bible through the hands of men. There was none of it that didn't come from writing from men. And the fact that we have so many to compare and contrast is a strength, and we thank you the way that you brought it, because had you just revealed it to mankind in one copy, we would have no way to verify what it says and what we believe. And so I pray, Lord, that over this next week and a half, 2 weeks, until we get back from Resurrection Celebration, that you would help us, that we would have a really good understanding about how we got our Bible and what these variants are about. And we thank you for this. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.